she said. I want to know why they did this to us, why they made us sick. I want to know if there's a cure. He stopped walking. He stared at her. There's no cure, he said. Not that we know of, she said, but you said yourself you didn't know exactly what they were doing at Haven. There could be a cure. They could have developed one.
Why would they?
He said. He looked as if he was trying not to smile. In that moment, she hated him. She'd never met someone who could make her have so many different feelings, who could make her feel at all, really. I don't know, she said. I don't know why they did anything. He looked at her, chewing on the inside of his cheek. She supposed that he wasn't ugly after all. She supposed that he was beautiful, in his own way, strange and angular, like the spiky plants that grew between the walkways at Haven, with a fan of dark green leaves. She'd overheard Gemma say that, on the phone in the car earlier. Maybe she hadn't thought Lyra was listening. There's a girl and a boy, she'd said. The girl is sick or something. The boy is... And she'd lowered her voice to a whisper. Beautiful. Lyra had never really thought of faces as beautiful before, although she had enjoyed the geometry of Jake's face, and she supposed in retrospect that Dr. O'Donnell had been beautiful. At least, she was in Lyra's memory. She wondered if she herself was ugly. Two lights appeared in the distance. She raised a hand to her eyes, momentarily dazzled and afraid, and then realized it was only an approaching car. But it began to slow, and she was afraid again. Somehow, instinctively, she and 72 took hands. His were large and dry and much nicer than the hands of the doctors, which, wrapped in disposable gloves, always felt both clammy and cold, like something dead.
You kids all right?
The man in the car had to lean all the way across the seat to talk to them through the open window. 72 nodded. Lyra was glad. She couldn't speak.
Funny place for a stroll, he said. You be careful, okay? There's cars come down this road 80-90 miles an hour.
He started to roll up his window and Lyra exhaled, relieved and also stunned. If he'd recognized them as replicas, it didn't seem like it. Maybe the differences weren't as obvious as she thought.
Hello!
She blurted out, and the window froze and then buzzed down again.
Hello!
She repeated, taking a step toward the car and ignoring 72, who hissed something, a warning, probably.
Have you heard of Palm Grove?
Palm Grove, Florida?
The man had thick, fleshy fingers, and a cigarette burned between them.
You weren't thinking of walking there, were you?
He said it half-laughing, as if he'd made a joke. But when she didn't smile, he squinted at her through the smoke unfurling from his cigarette.
The 12 goes straight up the coast to Palm Grove on its way to Tallahassee, if that's where you're headed. You can't miss the bus depot, but it's a hike, 5 or 6 miles at least.
Lyra nodded, even though she didn't know what he meant by the 12 or how far 5 or 6 miles was.
Won't catch a bus this late, though, the man said. Hope you got a place to stay the night.
He was still staring at her, but now his eyes ticked over her shoulder to 72 and back again. Something shifted in his face.
Hey, you sure you're okay? You don't look too good.
Lyra backed quickly away from the car.
I'm fine,
she said. We're fine. He stared at them for another long moment.
Watch out for the drivers down this stretch, like I said. They'll be halfway to Miami before they realize they got you.
Then he was gone and his taillights became the red tips of two cigarettes and then vanished.
You shouldn't speak to them, 72 said. You shouldn't speak to any of them.
He spoke to me, Lyra said. Besides, what harm did it do? 72 just shook his head, still staring in the direction the car had gone, as if he expected it might rematerialize.
What's in Palm Grove?
Someone who might be able to help, Lyra said carefully.
Who?
72 was backlit by the street lamp and all in shadow. She knew he might refuse to go with her, and if he did, she would still find her way to Palm Grove. They owed each other nothing. It was chance that had kept them together so far. Still, The idea of being completely on her own was terrifying. She had never been alone at Haven. At the very least, the guards had always been watching. But she saw no way to lie convincingly. She knew no one, had no one, in the outside world, and he knew that. "She was a nurse at Haven," she said.
"No," he said immediately and began walking again, kicking at the gravel and sending it skipping away across the road.
"Wait!" She got a hand around his arm, the one crisscrossed with all those vivid white scars. She turned him around and had a sudden shock. Just for a second, her body did something, told her something she didn't understand.
"No,"
he said again. She dropped his arm. She didn't know what she wanted from him, but she did, and that made her feel confused and exhausted and unhappy. "She's not like the other ones," she said. "Dr. O'Donnell had said, 'You're a good person.'" Even as Nurse M sobbed so that snot bubbled in her nostrils, "You want to make things right. I know you do." That had to mean it was true.
"How do you know that?" 72 said. He took a step forward and Lyra nearly tripped, trying to get away from him.
She didn't want to be anywhere near him, not after what had happened. Even standing several inches away, she felt a current moving through her body, something warm and alive, something that whispered. She hated it.
"I just know," she said. "She left Haven. She wanted to help us."
In her head, she added, "Because Dr. O'Donnell believed in her, because Dr. O'Donnell was always right." She wished, more than anything, that she knew where Dr. O'Donnell lived, and imagined once again the feel of Dr. O'Donnell's hand skimming the top of her head. Mother. She thought Dr. O'Donnell's house must be all white and very clean, just like Haven. But maybe instead of being on the ocean, it was in a field, and the smell of flowers came through the open windows on the wind. Another car went by, this time with a punch of music and rhythm. Then another car. This time the window went down and a boy had his head out of it, yelling something she couldn't make out. An empty can missed her head by only a few inches. For a long time, 72 just stared at her. She wondered again whether she was ugly, whether he realized that now, the same way she knew now that he was beautiful. As a replica, it had never mattered, and it shouldn't matter now, but it did. She wondered if this was the human world rubbing off on her, whether she might become more human by becoming uglier, by accepting it. She didn't want to be ugly in his eyes. Finally, he said, "We should get off the road and find somewhere to sleep for the night." She thought he almost smiled. "Well, we can't sleep here, and you heard him. There are no buses until morning." They moved off the road and walked instead through a scrum of crushed paper cups, cigarette butts, and empty plastic bags. Soon they came to an area of buildings groveling under the lights that encircled them, including a sign in neon that read, "Liquors." Lit as they were in starkness and isolation, they reminded Lyra briefly and painfully of Haven at night, when sleepily she would get up to use the bathroom and would look out and see the guard towers and floodlights making harsh angles out of the landscape. One of the building's pitched roofs tapered into the form of a cross, and so she thought it must be a church, although otherwise it was identical to its neighbors, shingle-sided and gray, separated by a narrow band of cracked pavement from a gas station and a diner, both closed for the night. Lyra saw that someone had written, "I was here," across the plywood and wasn't surprised. In a world this big, it must be easy to get lost and need reminders. Behind the church was a weed-choked field that extended toward another road in the distance, this one even busier. Headlights beaded down the thin fold in the dark like blood along a needle. But the noise was transformed by all the space into a constant shushing, like the sound of ocean waves. They shook out their blanket here, and Lyra was glad that they'd decided to sleep so close to the road and the lights. The space in between, the nothingness and distance, frightened her. The blanket was small, and when they lay down side by side on their backs, they couldn't help but touch. Lyra didn't know how she would sleep. Her body was telling her something again, urging her to move, to run, to touch him. Instead, she crossed her arms tightly and stared at the sky until the stars sharpened in her vision. She tried to pick out Cassiopeia. When she was little, she'd liked to pretend that stars were really lights anchoring distant islands, as if she wasn't looking up, but only out across a dark sea. She knew the truth now, but still found stars comforting, especially in their sameness. A sky full of burning replicas. "Do you know more stories?" Lyra was startled. She thought 72 was asleep. His eyes were closed and one arm was thrown across his face, so his voice was muffled. "What do you mean?" He withdrew the arm, but kept his eyes closed, so she was free to look at him. Again, his face looked very bare in the dark, as if during the day he wore a different face that only now, with his eyes closed, had rubbed away. She noticed the particular curve of his lips and nostrils, the smooth arrangement of his cheekbones, and wanted to touch and explore them with her fingers. "You can read. You told that story on the marshes about the girl, Matilda. You must know more, then." She thought of the little prince and its soft cover, creased through the illustration, its smudgy papers and its smell, now lost forever. She squeezed her ribs hard, half wishing she would crack. "Only one more good one," she said. "Tell it," he said. Again she was surprised. "What?" This time he opened his eyes, turning slightly to face her. "Tell it," he said, and then, "please." His lashes were very long. His lips looked like fruit, something to suck on. Now he did smile. She saw his teeth flash white in the dark. She looked away. The stars spun a little, dizzy above her. "There," she said, lifting an arm to point. "See that star?"
"Which one?"
"That one, the little twinkly one just next to the one that looks almost blue." It didn't matter whether he was looking at exactly the same star as she was, but after a moment he said, "I see it." "That's planet B612, she said. "It's an asteroid, actually, and that's where the little prince comes from." She closed her eyes, and in her head she heard echoes of Dr. O'Donnell's voice, smelled lemon soap, watched a finger tracking across the page, pointing out different words. "It's a small planet, but it's his. There are 3 volcanoes on the surface, 1 active, 2 inactive. And there are baobab plants that try and overgrow everything. There's a rose, too. The little prince loves the rose." This was the part of the book that had most confused her, but she said it anyway because she knew it was important.
"But who is the little prince?"
72 asked. "The little prince has golden hair, a scarf, and a lovable laugh," Lyra said, reciting from memory.
"What's lovable?"
72 asked. Lyra shifted. "It means..." She didn't know. "I guess it means someone loves you." 72 didn't say anything. She was going to continue her story, but she felt a bad pressure in her chest, as if someone was feeding a tube into her lungs. "How do you get to be loved?" 72 asked. His voice was quiet, slurred by sleep. "I don't know," Lyra answered honestly. She was glad when he fell asleep, or at least pretended to. She didn't feel like telling a story much after that. Lyra, Chapter 12. In the morning they were woken by a shout. Lyra thought they must have been spotted. Instead she saw a man in thick gloves loading trash from the dumpsters into an enormous truck. Momentarily hypnotized, she watched the trash flattened by machinery that looked like metal teeth. The smell was sweet and vaguely sickening. Still, she was hungry. Then she remembered the money they'd stolen from Gemma's wallet. 72 was awake now, too, and the man in the gloves stared at them as they stood and rolled up the blanket, stuffing it in their backpack, but said nothing. Lyra was beginning to understand that humans outside Haven didn't seem to care about them. Maybe their world was simply too big. They couldn't pay attention to all of it. 72 was hungry, too, so they went to the diner next to the gas station and took turns in the bathroom washing their faces and hands. Lyra even wet her scalp and brushed her teeth. There was a stack of small paper cups and electric blue mouthwash in a dispenser above the sink. When she returned to the table, 72 was fumbling with Jake's stolen phone.
"It won't stop ringing," he said.
And in fact, the phone lit up in his hands, sending out a tinny musical sound. "Let me try," she said. She'd seen cell phones before, but had only ever handled one once, when Nurse M, years ago, had shown Lyra pictures of her dog at home on the mainland. A Pomeranian, white and fluffy but otherwise rat-like, Lyra had thought, but hadn't said so. Maybe the dog was still alive. She didn't know how long dogs normally lived, and whether they outlasted replicas. She managed to get the phone to stop ringing and returned it to 72, who put it in his pocket. She wondered why he liked carrying it around if they had no one to call. Maybe it was because of what he'd said and why he'd escaped, just to see what it was like, just for a little. The menu was so full of writing that Lyra's head hurt looking at it. There was a whole section named Eggs. How many different ways could eggs be eaten? At Haven, they were always scrambled, crispy and brown on the bottom.
"It's a waste," 72 said. He seemed angry about the menu, all this food.
But she thought he was just angry about not being able to read. He made no mention of the story she'd started to tell him last night, of the little prince, and Lyra was glad. His question was still bothering her, as was the feeling she'd had afterward, a strange emptiness, as if she was already dead. A woman came to ask them what they wanted to eat. Lyra had never been asked that question before, and in that moment she deeply missed the Haven mess hall and the food lit orange beneath heating lamps and the way it was deposited onto their plates by sour-faced women wearing hairnets. 72 ordered coffee and eggs, so she ordered the same thing. The eggs were burned on the bottom and tasted like they did at Haven, which made her feel better. They paid with two of Gemma's bills and got a bewildering assortment of change back. Lyra couldn't help but think of the younger replicas and how they would have loved to play with all those coins, skipping them or rolling them across the floor, seeing who could get the most heads in a row. She wondered where all the other replicas were and imagined them in a new Haven, this one perhaps on a mountain and surrounded by the clean smell of pine, before remembering what they were. Carriers. Disposable. Lyra asked the waitress about Palm Grove, and she directed them up the road to the bus depot. "Can't miss it," she said. "Just take the 12 up toward Tallahassee. Soon as you see the water park, that's Palm Grove. You kids heading to the water park?" Lyra shook her head. The woman popped her gum. "That's too bad. They got one slide 3 stories tall. Cobra, it's called. And today's gonna be a bruiser. Where are you kids from?" But Lyra only shook her head again, and they stepped out into the heat. By the time they reached the bus depot, Lyra's shoes felt as if they were rubbing all the skin off her feet. She wasn't used to wearing shoes, but the asphalt was too hot for bare feet, and the shoulder was glittering with broken glass. While they waited for the bus, 72 lifted his shirt to wipe his face with it, and she saw a long trail of sweat tracking down the smoothness of his stomach and disappearing beneath the waistband of his pants. It did not disgust her. When the number 12 came, 72 was obviously proud, at least to be able to read the number. He nearly shouted it. But once they boarded, they learned they'd have to have a ticket. They had to get off the bus again and return inside, where the man behind the ticket desk shouted at them for holding up the line, for struggling with their dollars and giving over the wrong bills, and Lyra got flustered and spilled coins all over the floor. She was too embarrassed to pick the money up. Everyone was staring at her. Everyone knew. And instead, once they'd gotten their tickets, she and 72 hurried back outside, despite people calling after them. But the bus had gone, and they had to wait for a new one. Mercifully, the bus that arrived was mostly empty, so Lyra and 72 could get a seat in the back, far from the other passengers. It was better to ride in a bus than in a car. It made her less nauseous. But still, the world outside her window seemed to go by with dizzying speed, and there was ever more of it.
Highways rising up over new towns and then falling away into other highways, stretches of blank land burned by the sun into brownness, building and building and building like an endless line of teeth. After an hour, she spotted a monstrous coil of plastic rising into the air, twisting in snake-like and vivid blue, and an enormous billboard tacked into the ground announced, "Bluefin and Water Park," and several other words between them she didn't have time to read. They passed a parking lot glittering with cars and people, natural humans, children brown from the sun, only half-dressed and carting colorful towels, men and women herding them toward the entrance. She saw a mother crouching in front of a girl red in the face from crying, touching her face with a tissue. But the bus was moving too quickly, and soon a line of trees ran across her vision, obscuring it. The driver announced Palm Grove and stopped the bus in front of a run-down motel named the Starlight. Lyra had been imagining a grid of houses in pastel shades, like the neighborhood they'd left in the middle of the night. But Palm Grove was big. Big roads with two lanes of traffic, restaurants and gas stations, clothing stores and places to buy groceries. Signs shouted at them from every corner. Milk, $3.99. Guys and Dolls. Albert Irving Auditorium, Saturday. 1 hour parking Monday through Saturday. She didn't even see any houses, and she counted at least a dozen people on the streets, passing in and out of shops, talking on phones. It was so hot it felt like being inside a body, beneath the skin of something, filmy and slick. How many humans could possibly be here in one town?
"And now what?" 72 said. He'd been in a bad mood all morning, ever since she had asked him why he had the scars on his forearms, which were different from the scars she and the other replicas had. The ones from spinal taps and harvesting procedures, all of it she knew now to test how deep the prions had gone, how fast they were cloning themselves, how soon the replicas would die. He had only said "accident," and had barely spoken to her on the bus. Instead, he had sat with his chin on his chest, his arms folded, his eyes shut. She had counted 14 scars, 4 on his right and 10 on his left. She had noticed a small mole on his earlobe, had felt a secret thrill at sitting so close after years of seeing no male replicas at all. "Trust me," Lyra said, which is what the nurses always said. "Shh. Trust me. Just a little pinch. Stop with that noise. Trust me. It'll all be over soon." Lyra worked up the courage to stop the first person she saw who looked to be about her age. The girl was sitting on the curb in front of a store called Diggs and was bent over her cell phone typing on it. When she looked up, Lyra saw that she was wearing makeup and was vaguely surprised. She'd somehow thought makeup was for older humans like the nurses.
"Hello," she said. "We're looking for Emily Huang."
"Emily Huang?"
The girl looked Lyra up and down, and then her eyes went to 72. She straightened up, giving him a smile that reminded Lyra of the actresses the nurses used to watch on TV and look at in magazines they left lying around sometimes. Lyra didn't like it, and she was for the first time aware of the difference between her body and this girl's. This girl was all curves and prettiness, all smooth skin and beautiful solidity and long, flowing hair. Lyra, in her drab clothing and her sharp bones and the scar above her eyebrow, thought of that word again. Ugly.
"Emily Huang?"
the girl repeated. "She go to Wallace?"
I don't think so."
Lyra suddenly wished they hadn't stopped.
"Sorry."
The girl did look sorry, but she kept her eyes on 72.
"Don't know her."
Then she turned and gave Lyra a smile that wasn't friendly, more like she'd just eaten something she shouldn't have.
"Cool scalp, by the way. Dig the cancer kid look."
They went on. Lyra could still feel the girl staring and wondered if 72 did too. All he said was, "Too many people." And she nodded because her throat was too tight to speak. "Ugly." Which meant the other girl was pretty. What a strange way to live, among all these people. It made Lyra feel small, even less important than she had among the thousands of replicas grown like crops in the barracks. The next person she stopped was older and ugly, wrinkles that made it look as if her face was melting, pouchy bits of skin waggling under her chin. But she didn't know who Emily Huang was. They stopped a man and a boy about 12 who rode a flat thing fitted with wheels that Lyra remembered only belatedly was called a skateboard. No one knew Emily Huang, and Lyra didn't like the look the man gave them. She was hot and thirsty and losing hope. The town kept expanding. Every time they came to the end of a block, she saw a new street branching off it with more buildings and more people.
"We're never going to find her," 72 said, and she disliked the fact that he sounded happy about it, as if he'd proven a point. "We might as well keep walking."
"Just hold on," she said. "Hold on." Spots of color floated up in front of her vision. Her t-shirt clung to her back. She took a step and found the pavement floated up to meet her. She grabbed hold of a street sign, loading dock, no standing, to keep from falling.
"Hey."
72's voice changed. His arm skimmed her elbow. "Are you all right?"
"Hot,"
she managed to say.
"Come on," he said, "with me. You need water. And shade."
Almost directly across the street was a park that reminded her of the courtyard at Haven, down to the statue standing at its center. This one was of a woman, though, her hands held together in prayer, her head bowed. Tall trees cast the lawns in shade, and benches lined the intersecting pathways. 72 kept a hand on her elbow, even though she insisted he didn't need to. She did feel better once she'd taken a drink of water from a water fountain and found a bench in the shade where she could rest for a bit. Somewhere in the branches, birds twittered out messages to one another. It was pretty here. Peaceful. The park ran up to an enormous red brick building, portions of its facade encased in glossy sheets of climbing ivy. Lyra saw another cross stuck above the glass double doors and the letters beside it. Wallace High School. Her heart jumped. Wallace. The girl on the street had mentioned Wallace.
"What do you want to do now?"
72 was being extra nice, which made Lyra feel worse. She knew he thought they'd failed. She knew he knew how sick she was. Without answering him, she stood up. She'd just seen someone moving behind the glass doors, and she went forward as if drawn by the pull of something magnetic.
"Lyra!"
72 shouted after her, but she didn't stop. It didn't take him long to catch up with her. But by then she was already standing in front of Wallace, and a woman had emerged, carrying a stack of folders.
"Can I help you?" the woman said, and Lyra realized she'd been standing there staring.
"We're looking for Emily Huang,"
Lyra said quickly before she could lose her nerve. Remembering what the girl had said, Lyra added, "We think she may go to Wallace?" She wasn't sure what that meant either, and she held her breath, hoping the woman did. The woman slid on a pair of glasses, which she was wearing on a chain. Blinking up at Lyra, she resembled a turtle, down to the looseness of the skin around her neck.
"Emily Huang,"
the woman said, shaking her head.
"No.
No, she never went here." Lyra's heart dropped. Another no. Another dead end. But then the woman said,
"But she came every career day to talk to the kids about the work she did. Terrible, some of the stuff they said about her later. She was a good girl. I liked her very much."
"So you know her?" Lyra said. She was dizzy with sudden joy. "Nurse M, she would help. She would protect them. You know where we can find her?" The woman gave her a look Lyra couldn't quite read.
"Knew her," she said slowly. "She lived right over on Willis Street, just behind the school. Can't miss it. A sweet yellow house and all those flower beds. Woman who lives there now has let it go to seed."
And just like that, the happiness was gone, evaporated.
"She's gone?"
Lyra said. "Do you know where she went?" The woman shook her head again. And then Lyra did know how to name her expression. Pity.
"Not gone, honey," she said. "Never left, some say. Hung herself right there in her living room. Must be 3-4 years ago now.
Emily Huang's dead."
Lyra didn't know what made her want to see the place where Emily Huang had lived.
When she asked for directions to Willis Street, 72 didn't question her, and she was glad. She wouldn't have known how to explain. Behind the school, they found quiet residential streets running like spokes away from the downtown, and houses at last. These concealed not behind walls, but standing there pleasantly right on their lawns, with flowers waving from flower boxes and vivid toys scattered in the grass. It was pretty here, and she couldn't imagine why Emily Huang would have been so unhappy, why she would have killed herself like poor Pepper had. Then again she remembered how Nurse M had sobbed and Dr. O'Donnell had held her by the shoulders. "I know you," she'd said. "You're a good person. I know you were just in over your head." So maybe she was unhappy even then. Nurse M's old house had once, the old woman had told them, been the yellow of sunshine and thus easy to spot. Now it was a faded color that reminded Lyra of mustard. The flower beds looked scraggly, and there were four bikes dumped on the front lawn and so many toys it looked as if these were coming up from the ground. Loud music came to them across the lawn. She closed her eyes and arranged all her memories of Nurse M in a row. Nurse M bathing Lyra and a dozen other replicas when they were too young to do it themselves, plunging them into the bath water and hauling them like slippery, wriggling puppies onto the cold tile floor afterward. Nurse M standing with Dr. Saperstein in the courtyard, speaking in a low voice, and the way he said, "It's nothing. They don't understand." After Nurse M turned around and caught Lyra staring, the time in the janitor's closet with Dr. O'Donnell. "I'm sorry," 72 said, and Lyra opened her eyes. Maybe he wasn't angry at her anymore. His eyes were softened with color. It was the first time anyone had ever apologized to her. "For what?" "I know you were hoping she would help," 72 said. "Now we have no one," Lyra said. She pressed a hand to her eyes. She didn't want 72 to see how upset she was. "Nowhere to go, either." 72 hesitated. He touched the back of her hand. "You have me," he said very quietly. She looked up at him, surprised. Her skin tingled where he touched her. "I do?" she said. She felt hot in her head and chest, but it was a good feeling, like standing in the sun after being too long in the air conditioning. He nodded. "You have me," he said. "I have you." He looked as if he might say more, but just then in the house next to Emily Huang's, the garage door rattled open, revealing an enormously fat woman in a tracksuit. She waddled out, dragging a trash bin, keeping her eyes on 72 and Lyra. Lyra stepped from him. She felt as if they'd been caught in the middle of something, even though they'd just been standing there. She waited for the woman to turn around and return inside, but instead she just stood there at the end of the driveway, one hand on the trash bin, breathing hard and staring. "You need something?" she called out to them when she had caught her breath. She pulled her T-shirt away from her skin. A large sweat stain had darkened between her breasts. "No," 72 said quickly. But the woman kept staring at them, and so Lyra added, "We came looking for Emily Huang. We were friends." She enjoyed the way the word sounded and felt like repeating it, but bit her tongue so she wouldn't. The woman's face changed, became narrower as if she were speaking to them through a half-open door. "You knew Emily?" Lyra had never had to lie so much in her life. She wondered if lying, too, was a human trait. She fumbled for an excuse, and for a second her brain turned up nothing but white noise. "What was the word again? Parents?" she said finally. It came to her like a match striking. "She was friends with our parents." Even 72 turned to look at her. Her cheeks were hot. This lie felt different, heavier. The word parents had left a thick feeling in her throat, as if it had slugged its way up from her stomach. She was sure that the woman would know that she was lying, but instead she just made a desperate flapping motion. It wasn't until 72 moved that Lyra realized the woman was gesturing them forward.
In!
She had a funny duck-like walk. She kept turning around to see that they were following her.
Come on, come on!
Lyra didn't have enough experience to wonder whether it was safe to follow a stranger into her house, and soon they were standing in the coolness of the garage, and the door was grinding closed behind them, like an eyelid squeezing shut and wedging out all the light. The garage smelled faintly of fertilizer and chemicals.
"Sorry for being a push,"
the woman said, moving to a door that must, Lyra knew, connect with the house.
"You never know who's watching around here. Nosy Nellies, that's what everyone is. That was Em's problem. You ask me, trusted all the wrong people."
She opened the door.
"I'm Sherry, by the way. Sherry Hayes. Come on in and have a chat with me. You kids look like you could use a lemonade or a bite to eat."
Lyra and 72 didn't look at each other, but she knew what he was thinking. These real humans were not like the ones at Haven. They were nice. Helpful. Then again, they didn't know what Lyra and 72 really were. Lyra had a feeling that they wouldn't be quite so helpful then. She imagined the inside of her body rotted, filled with disease, and wondered if soon it would begin to show on her outside and the look of her face.
"Well, come on! Don't just stand there gawping! I'm sweating buckets!"
They followed the woman, Sherry, into the house. Lyra was startled by a cat that streaked across the hall directly in front of her and jumped back.
"Oh, you're not allergic, are you? I've got three of them. Tabby, Tammy, Tommy. All littermates. Little terrors, every last one. But don't worry, they won't bite you."
Lyra saw another two cats perched on a sofa in a darkened living room, their eyes moon bright and yellow. Her heart was still hammering. She wasn't used to animals roaming free like that. At Haven, the animals were kept in cages. She was glad they went instead into the kitchen. Sherry sat them down at a wooden table and brought them two glasses of lemonade and tall glasses filled to the rim with ice cubes. It was delicious. She laid out cookies, too, a whole plate of them.
"So, where do you kids come from?"
Sherry asked, and Lyra froze, caught off guard again. 72 moved his thumb over a knot in the table, but Sherry just made a kind of clucking noise.
"I see," she said. "Let me guess. Emily helped place you with your parents, didn't she? You went through the Home Foundation?"
Lyra didn't know what she was talking about, so she stayed quiet, and Sherry seemed to take that for a yes.
"Of course she did. You two don't look a lick alike," she sighed.
"Poor Emily. You knew her well, then."
"In a way,"
Lyra said carefully. She knew Nurse M had never hit the replicas or cursed them for being demons. She knew that Dr. O'Donnell thought she was a good person who wanted to make things right. She knew she'd been younger than many of the other nurses because she'd overheard Dr. O'Donnell say that, too. "You're young. You didn't know what you were doing. No one will blame you."
"She was a good girl. All that work she did for other people, I could have killed them for what they said about her in the papers after she died. It came as a shock to me, you know, a real shock. We'd been talking about a barbecue that very weekend. She called me the day it happened, asked if I wanted macaroni salad or potato."
Sherry shook her head.
"Now what kind of person about to hang herself is worried about macaroni or potato salad?"
Lyra knew she wasn't expected to answer. Sherry went on.
"Too sad. She was still young, too. 34, 35. I think there must have been a man involved, maybe more than one. Well, I suppose there were signs. You know, after they found her body, I did a little bit of Googling, found out some of the warning signs. Of course, I didn't see them before, but she did give away some of her things the week before she died, and that's right up there to look for. Giving away prized possessions. Of course, at the time, I thought she was just being nice."
"What do you mean there was a man involved?" 72 asked, and Lyra was surprised as ever to hear him speak. She realized he hardly spoke unless they were alone. Somehow this made her feel special. Her glass was empty but still cold, and she pressed it to her neck.
"Well, isn't there always?"
She raised her eyebrows.
"Besides, it would have been hard not to notice those men in and out.
Just once or twice, of course, as far as I could tell. Suited-up types, like in finance or something, but mean-looking.
Lyra thought of the suits who'd come to inspect Haven sometimes and felt a curious prickling down the back of her spine. Those men, like the nurses had always called them. Sherry shook her head.
But there's no accounting for taste, I always say.
Lyra grasped for some idea of what to ask next, of what any of this meant or whether it mattered. You said she was giving away her things? She said, suddenly struck by what this might mean. She gave you something, didn't she? Lyra asked. Maybe, she thought, Nurse M had left Sherry something important. Maybe she'd left her something that related to Haven and to the work they were doing there, to the prions, to a cure. Sherry had taken a seat. Now she placed both palms on the table to stand up.
Never been able to find a place for them, but can't bring myself to throw 'em out either. Oh, she told me I could take the damn things apart and sell the frames if I wanted, but of course I never would.
She moved off into another room. 72 gave Lyra a questioning look, and she shrugged. She didn't know what she was waiting for or looking for anymore, only that out there, in the real world, there were no answers, nothing but vastness and things she'd never seen in real life, and experiences she couldn't understand, and strangers who didn't know what she was and would hate her if they did, nothing but the disease, nothing but being nothing and then dying nothing. At Haven, she never wanted anything, not in any way that counted. She'd been hungry, tired, bored, and sick. She'd wanted more food, cold water, more sleep for the pain to end, to go outside, but she'd never had a want that moved her, where the goal felt not like an end, but a beginning. She'd never had a purpose. But now she did. She wanted to understand. And this single fact made her feel more human, more worthy than she ever had before. She was shocked to feel 72's hand in hers. She looked up at him and felt the same strange thing happen to her body, as if she was transformed to air. He pulled away when Sherry returned to the room carrying 3 framed photographs. She plunked them down on the table.
"Well, you see, they're not exactly my taste," Sherry said.
The pictures were all illustrations. Lyra guessed they came from the same anatomy textbook. She'd seen many similar pictures in the medical textbooks at Haven.
"I like my kittens and my watercolors and oils here and there. Never been much for drawing."
Lyra thought the drawings were beautiful. She loved the sinewy look of the muscles, the precision of the bones, and even the faded lettering too small to make out, labeling different physical features. But even so, she was horribly disappointed. There was nothing here, no secret message or miracle cure. Somewhere in the house, a phone rang. Sherry stood up again.
"It never ends, does it?" she said. "Give me just a minute."
As soon as she left, another cat, this one gray, leapt onto the table, and Lyra instinctively grabbed one of the framed illustrations to keep the cat from stepping on it.
"Why have cats in a house?"
72 whispered to her. But she couldn't answer, even though she'd been wondering the same thing. She'd felt an irregularity in the canvas backing, and she flipped the frame over, her chest suddenly cavernous with hope. The canvas had at one time been stapled to the wooden frame. On 2 sides of the rectangular canvas, the staples were in place. But on 2 sides, they were missing, and instead had been replaced with gobs of glue at inch-long intervals, some of which had seeped out and hardened onto the wood. Lyra and the other replicas had spent too long at Haven searching for places to hide their limited belongings, not to suspect that the picture Nurse M had given Sherry was in fact concealing something else behind it. Nurse M had told Sherry she could take the damn things apart. What if she had meant that Sherry should take the damn things apart? The phone had stopped ringing, and Sherry's voice, muffled by the walls, was now nothing more than tones. She must have closed a door. Before she could lose her nerve, Lyra pried a corner of the canvas from the frame and ripped.
"What are you doing?"
72 reached out and seized Lyra's wrist as if to stop her.
"Nurse M gave these pictures away before she died,"
Lyra whispered. "Maybe she was hiding something." Fearing both that she would find something and that she wouldn't, she slipped a hand behind the canvas. Almost immediately, her fingers landed on several loose items. Glossy, slick photographs. 72 stared as she laid them out on the table. There were three of them, each showing Nurse M with a tall, dark-haired man who had a beard and a sour expression. In one photograph, Nurse M was sitting on his lap, and he was turning away from the camera. In another, she was kissing him on the cheek, and he was lifting a hand as if to block them from the lens. But in the last one, she'd caught him square on, or someone else had. They were standing in front of a nondescript stretch of highway. There was a scruffy range of blue hills in the distance. She was holding on to a straw hat and looked happy. Lyra felt sick for reasons she couldn't say. "Dr. Saperstein," 72 said, naming him first. Lyra could only nod. The man in the pictures was unmistakably Dr. Saperstein, whom Lyra had always thought of a little like the humans thought about their god. Someone remote and all-powerful, someone through whom the whole world was ordered. Lyra could no longer hear Sherry talking, but after a minute there was a quick burst of laughter from the other room, and she knew they still had a little time. "Quick," she said, "help me check the other frames." She flipped over the second picture. Like the first, its backing had been pulled away from the frame and then re-glued, but this one had been done more carefully and was difficult to detach. 72 leaned across her, knife in hand, and neatly sliced the canvas, barely missing her fingers. "It's faster," he said, and leaned across her to slit open the back of the third picture. They found, behind the second picture, a folded sheet of paper that looked at first glance to be a list of names and a typed document, although Lyra didn't have time to try and read it. She didn't have time to check the third picture frame either. At that moment, she heard a door open, and Sherry's voice suddenly amplified. "I'll call you tomorrow," she was saying. "I'm being rude." Sherry would only have to glance at the frames to know what they had done and to guess probably that something had been removed from behind the pictures. Without speaking, she and 72 stood up from the table and moved as quietly as they could to the back door, which opened out onto a little patio. Sherry was still trying to get off the phone. Lyra saw her pass momentarily into view and froze, one hand on the door handle. "I have guests," Sherry was saying, "but I was listening, I promise." Then Sherry, who was pacing, passed out of view again without looking up. Lyra eased open the screen door, wincing when it squeaked on its hinges. 72 ducked outside onto the stone patio. One of the cats was still staring at her, unblinkingly, and for a terrifying second, Lyra thought it might open its mouth and let out a wail of alarm. But it made not a sound, and so Lyra slipped after 72, closing the door behind her. Lyra. Chapter 13. Lyra half expected Sherry to come running after them, and they were several blocks away before she thought that they were probably safe. They found another park with several dirty sandboxes and a rusted swing set at its center. But there were trees here, and shade, and they were alone. She examined the pictures again, one by one. She'd seen romance on the nurses' televisions, of course, and heard the staff at Haven talk about boyfriends and girlfriends and wives and husbands. She knew about it. But knowing about what humans did, the kinds of relationships they had on TV, was different from seeing and holding proof of this. Dr. Saperstein had struck her not so much as human, but as some bloodless stone deity come to life. She had never once seen him smile. True, he wasn't smiling in these pictures either, but he was dressed in T-shirts and striped shorts and a baseball hat, like he could have been anybody. This made him more frightening to her, not less. She thought of the snakes at Haven that left their long golden skins on the ground, brittle and husk-like. Nurse M was hardly recognizable. She looked so happy. Lyra thought again of the last time she'd seen her, sobbing into Dr. O'Donnell's arms, and she had killed herself, using a rope instead of a knife, as Pepper had. What had happened? Sherry had mentioned men in suits visiting Nurse M before she died. Was Dr. Saperstein one of them? Before looking at the photographs, Lyra had never seen him in anything but a lab coat. She unfolded the list. 72 leaned over her. He smelled sweet, as if he was sweating soap.
"What does it say?"
he asked impatiently, and she had the sudden ridiculous urge to take his hand to tuck herself into the space between his arm and shoulder, as Nurse M and Dr. Saperstein were doing in the picture. She read instead 34 names, all names she didn't know, nobody she recognized from Haven, in alphabetical order. Donald Bartlett, Caroline Chow, Brandy Nicole Harless. She stopped. That name seemed somehow familiar, and yet she couldn't think why. But rereading it gave her the weirdest sensation, like when the doctors used to bang her on the knee to test her reflexes and she would see her body jerk, like something inside of her was stirring. The second piece of paper Lyra had trouble deciphering at first. It wasn't a list, but a full page of writing, and it picked up in the middle of a sentence. As Lyra began to read, she had the impression that Nurse M was talking to her, to an invisible other body that existed beyond the page. "Eggs on my car," it began. Lyra read the phrase several times, trying to make sense of it, before she decided there must have been a first sheet that had gotten lost. She kept reading, and both because it was easier for her to spell the words out and 72 was getting impatient, she read slowly, out loud. "Mark tells me not to worry so much. I know they're kooks." Lyra stumbled a little over the word since she'd never heard it. "But they aren't that far off. Someone stopped me the other day after I caught the ferry." "They're raising zombies, aren't they?" she said. "A normal woman. Someone you'd see at the grocery store." She continued reading. "It gave me chills, Ellen. I felt for a second as if she knew. Is it really so different, after all? I tell you, I never thought I'd miss Philadelphia. I don't miss the winters, that's for sure, but I miss you, Elbo, and I miss how simple things felt back then. I even miss that shitty apartment we found through Drexel, remember? And that stupid ex-boyfriend of yours who used to throw cans at your window. Ben? Sometimes I even miss our coursework. At least, I felt like we were on the right path. I know what you'll say, it's the same thing Mark says, and I believe in the science, I do. If a parent loses a child, well, to have that child back? Who wouldn't want that? Who wouldn't try? When I think of people like Jeffrey Ives, all the money in the world and a dead baby that he couldn't save and all he wants is to make it better, to undo it. But is it right? Mark thinks so, but I don't know, I can't decide. Dr. Haven wants to keep the NIH out of our hair, so he stays clear of dealing with the clinics, even though they've got fetal tissue they'll sell off for just the transportation fee. But already the funds are running thin. I don't think there's any way we'll last unless we get federal support. But if good old George W. outlaws spending on the research... Then there's the question of Dr. Haven. Ever since he went into AA, he's been changing. Mark worries he'll shut down the program, shut down the whole institution... He doesn't seem to be sure, at least not anymore. And if the donor's money dries up, we'll have to go in a totally new direction. Mark thinks there might be other ways. Military research, cures. The writing stopped. Lyra flipped over the page, but there was nothing more. She'd either been interrupted or the rest of what she'd said had been lost. Lyra also assumed from the reference to an Ellen, a name, that Nurse M must have been intending the message for someone specific. She had never passed it on, but she'd felt it was important enough to hide well, and to deliver to someone before she died. Was she hoping Sherry would find it? What was Nurse M hoping she'd see? It was a puzzle. It was data. It was a code, like DNA was. All codes could be read if you only knew the key. For a long minute, she and 72 stood there in silence, in the shadow of a construction of wood and rope and plastic, whose purpose she didn't know. Codes everywhere. That was the problem with the outside world. The human world. The whole thing was made up of puzzles, of a language she didn't quite speak. "What does it mean?" 72 asked finally, and she realized... that was the question. About standing in the park, about him and his moods and the way he sometimes rubbed the back of his neck as if something was bothering him there, about their escape and the fact that they were dying anyway, but she didn't feel like she was dying. She didn't feel like dying. What does it mean?
She had never asked that question.
She forced herself to reread, squinting as if she could squeeze more meaning from the letters that way. She knew that Haven made replicas from human tissue, and she knew, of course, that it must have come from humans, people. She knew there were hospitals and clinics that did business with Haven, although she didn't know how she knew this exactly. It was just a fact of life, like the cots and the stew pot and failure to thrive. And she knew what zombies were. The nurses had talked about them, about several zombie movies and how scary they were. Lyra explained what they were to